My name is Toby Lanza. I'm the Assistant Secretary General and the Regional Humanitarian Coordinator for the Sahel region in Africa.
Could you describe the range of crises taking place in the Sahel right now?
I think in the Sahel, we're experiencing a very dangerous cocktail, which has three principal ingredients. The first one is terrible, terrible poverty. People across the region are probably the poorest on earth, and this has been going on for a very, very long time. The second ingredient is what I call violent extremism. It's groups such as Boko Haram, it's groups such as Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, who are wreaking havoc with people's lives in different parts of the Sahel. And the third ingredient is climate change, something that was just recently discussed, of course, in Paris, and something which touches everybody everywhere. But in particular, it hits the poorest the hardest. And it's very clear to us on the ground in the Sahel that the impact of climate change varies, but it can mean flash floods or not enough rain. And it just makes people's lives much more difficult. So that's the situation across the Sahel, and it's compounded in a way by a fourth factor, which makes the situation not only dangerous today, but probably even worse tomorrow unless we tackle this issue, and that's known as population growth. Women across the Sahel very often have 6, 7, perhaps 8 or 9 children, and the population in most countries is set to double roughly every 20 years. So if there are 150 million people across the Sahel today, it means that in just 20 years' time, there will be as many as 300 million, as many as 600 million in 40 years' time. And of course, that sounds like a long, long, long way away, but time flies.
With such varying circumstances and needs, what goes into planning a regional response strategy, one that adequately addresses all the different local contexts?
I think the first thing is that what we're really looking at is the humanitarian consequences of this dangerous mix. And we have tremendous levels of pain and suffering just in an area known as the Lake Chad Basin. That's the north of Cameroon and the west of Chad and the southeast of Niger and the northeast of Nigeria. We've got over 2.5 million people who have been forced to flee from their homes, villages burned, lives ruined. So the humanitarian consequences of this are very apparent. People need shelter, they need medicine, they need food. Across the region, there are pockets such as that, and another one would be Mali. But if you look at the Sahel itself, I think that our humanitarian response is far more sophisticated than just keeping people alive. We're trying to give people not only a hand out, but also a hand up, in the sense that we want to strengthen their ability to handle shocks, to adapt to situations, to weather a storm. We want to help people build their resilience and have a brighter tomorrow. We want to help kids get into school and finish school. We want to make sure that mums can have access to clinics and to make sure that people's stomachs are full and they're well fed and well nourished.
How do you proceed with this planning, these strategies? What are your challenges?
Well, we've got teams on the ground in every country. So they look at the situation, they work with the local populations and the local authorities, and they analyze the context. What's happening? What's driving people's needs? How do we make sure that we can tackle the right priorities? We then draw up a plan, and hopefully donors come along and say, here's the money you require to implement your programs. Now, it's very important for the donors to come along at the right time. We know from the planting season, for example, that if you're too late, it's lost. And if you don't plant, you won't harvest. And so tackling that issue of food insecurity, you know, it's crucial to get the right steps in place at the right time of the year and to work with donors on that. And so whether it's with local populations or local authorities, whether it's with UN agencies and NGOs or with the donors themselves, there's a very, I would call it, integrated and collaborative approach that we take to planning throughout the countries of the Sahel to try to get people in need the best protection and assistance on time.
So planning and execution very much hinges on the donor response and the funding that you have. Can you think of a situation where the money didn't come in? What were the consequences or implications?
Each year we struggle to get money on time, or we struggle to get enough money. And so that means you have to take very tough decisions. Some clinics will get medicines. Some schools will get textbooks. Some kids will get a bowl of porridge and others won't. Those are the realities that we face. Some farmers will get the inputs that they require for the planting season and others will not. It's important also, though, to manage expectations and to communicate very, very openly with communities and with the authorities, because I want to be clear, the role of the UN and our partners is not to substitute. We are there to complement and to support. And so the heavy lifting has to be done by communities themselves and by the authorities, the institutions of the states across the Sahel. Not an easy task because the countries are very poor. However, I am calling for much more engagement by the governments across the region in basic social services to provide schools and clinics, but also to make sure that farmers, whether smallholders or others, or pastoralists and their livestock, can be better cared for, can be safer, and can manage to earn a livelihood.
So I'm Vincent Martin. I'm the FAO representative in Senegal, and I'm also coordinating resilience and emergency team covering West Africa and the Sahel.
And how does strategic planning work from an FAO perspective? What do you do?
So we have a plan, which is not just the plan of FAO, but a 3 years plan, which is set up by the UN and which is coordinated by the regional humanitarian coordinator. Within this plan, all the agencies all together tried to set up some activities for the next 3 years so that we can answer at the same time the most urgent needs, but also respond to the medium to long-term requirements of the population so that we really start to implement the resilience agenda and not just leave out a part of the population that needs much more than just immediate assistance. Within this humanitarian regional plan, and we've just launched a 2016 one in December in Dakar, FAO has its own component. And this component is about agriculture and food security. This is also not just FAO working alone in the field to try to accomplish some objectives. This is FAO working with other UN agencies like WFP, like UNHCR, like IOM, working together to support the governments in the countries so that they can better respond to the emergency situation and the crisis that they are facing. And there are so many crises at the moment.
It's interesting that you mention situations where there's both immediate needs and long-term development needs that you have to kind of work at in tandem. Because earlier in this podcast, we heard from our FAO communications person in the field who visited Sudan, who explored communities where part of the problem is them scourging for any kind of sustenance and living off of very minimal amounts of food because they didn't have access, and FAO and other agencies didn't have access to this area. And at the same time, she also discussed FAO's work in providing local fishermen with boats and tools they needed to sustain themselves. Mm-hmm. Now, what are the challenges when doing that kind of work? Like, how do you approach the immediate crises and long-term development stuff at the exact same time?
I think this is one of the strengths of FAO. We used to be very much oriented towards long-term development approaches in all parts of the world. Because many crises were rising in different places, we realized that it was also needed for us to engage in the humanitarian work and to be able also to respond and to provide some emergency agriculture inputs to the population. So we have both this culture of working on long-term development issues, but also on being able to respond rapidly to any kind of crisis you've seen during the last years. I'm thinking also of animal health and human health crisis, pandemics. We've got a huge expertise to be able to respond to these kind of pandemics. These days where I'm working in the Sahel and I can see all these different aspects and the diversity and the complexity of the crisis we are facing. And we have this capacity to make this bridge, to strengthen this relationship between humanitarian actions and with our partners who are very much focusing on that, and also putting up the expertise we've developed over the years on development issues, on creating the right environment for government to be able to take leadership in their activities. And here I would like to mention one thing. We've been discussing about all the challenges we are facing in this region and all these aggravating factors, such as climate change, such as demographic, such as insecurity. But one element which is important is also to look at the structure of the population and the youth population that is coming up in the next years. you've got something like 10 to 12 million young people which are arriving on the labour market every year, and just one-fifth of them can get access to a decent employment. So it leaves so many people on the margin. So the question is, apart from responding to these emergency needs in these countries, what is the future of these generations which are arriving on the labour market? What can we offer in the rural or agricultural sector that can be attractive enough that in the end they don't go and the quick solution and the easiest solution with everything which is offered to them with terrorism, drug trafficking, and so on and so forth. So we need ourselves to provide the tools to the governments, to work with the governments, to make sure that we develop strategies for youth employment. This is resilience. We develop strategy for social protection. How do we link the long-term social protection schemes with the emergency activities different types of agencies have in these countries? So this is really what we are trying to do. We have a huge challenge ahead, and we try to connect the dots, and we try to, yes, to link these emergency actions to long-term development issues such as youth employment, social protection, agricultural development.
Can you think of a situation where there was a specific intervention that had a very successful outcome?
Well, I've got plenty of examples. When I go to the field, I meet the beneficiaries, I talk to them, I try to get their story. These people, they have basic needs and they just want to eat three times a day and they want to be able to have access to healthcare systems. So it's quite basic. And we, at our level, sometimes we embark in very complex and strategic thinking. But in the end, we have to respond to these very basic needs of humans and people who need that. When I go to the field to see what is the impact of our activities, I've met several people who were so happy that we were there on time and with very, very basic infrastructure. I remember one lady who we helped them to fence their one big plot of land so that they could produce vegetables on a more sustainable manner. And because of that, they organized themselves into a group of women's association, and they were in a very remote area of Senegal, facing droughts and inundations and all sorts of things. And then all of a sudden they could produce, and they didn't have to travel for 6 hours to walk, basically, because they don't have cars. They didn't have to walk 6 or 7 hours to go to the first marketplace and buy their food. And they could even generate some income. And then all of a sudden, the other people in the community, first of all, they could come and buy their food at this place. This women's association, they had increased revenues. And then in the next villages, they wanted to create the same thing because they were realizing you don't need that much to become independent, to have the power of paying the education fees or health fees. So it can be very simple actions. Or giving them access to lands. That's something also which is very important. In some places, they don't have access to the land. So we can create the good conditions by talking with the mayor of the city and so on, so that they can allocate some lands to these women or these young people, and then they can start producing. And then they realize, well, maybe there is a future here. I can do something. I can start a business.
I'll open up these last three questions. Anyone can feel free to speak. Do you find that the regional strategies sometimes take away from the national strategies of particular countries, or are they always kind of complementary?
There are different types of strategy or ways to address a problem at the regional or national level. In the case of the humanitarian response plan, for example, it comes from the countries, and it's more than an aggregation of country programs. It's a country programs which are linked together with a regional dimension. So on this particular one, which is the humanitarian response plan for the one we've just launched for 2016, my feeling is that it's quite coherent and it's perfectly in adequation with what countries are trying to build. The regional level just tries to give maybe a longer-term perspective, try to see actually how we can link this emergency immediate response to the more longer-term activities. And we can build up on good practices and exchange that at the regional level, thing that maybe at the country level you are not necessarily aware of.
Anything to add?
I think the main issue is whether one lives in a village or a town, one is part of a bigger picture. And whether one lives in country A or B, when it comes to the Sahel, many of the challenges facing communities are common. And so having a regional approach makes sense and is not so complicated on some topics as one may imagine. Things tend to be only complicated by us. For the communities on the ground, whether one is in the north of Mali or in the northeast of Nigeria, the issues of climate change, of violent extremism, of abject poverty are ever present. And getting a hand from an NGO or a UN agency to help weather that storm is useful. So I think that there are some coherence issues within the UN system that we've been trying to address for the past few years, and donors have high expectations on us in that regard. There are efficiency arguments for working more coherently and more collaboratively. And so, of course, from my perspective as the regional humanitarian coordinator, it makes sense.
How do you mobilize people and donors around crises that are recurrent and seemingly endless, selling them and bringing back in their support? Because a lot of crises are competing against each other in a sense. So how do you do that?
You know, that's a very important question. And I often ask people, so why should I expect you to care? The fact that people are poor or that they're down and out should be enough, but it can't be enough, can it? Because actually, there are lots of people who are poor and there are lots of people who are down and out. And so what I try to do is listen to people in these communities. What is it that has struck them? How is their life? And how can I mobilize attention or resources so that we can make their lives a little bit better? And I think that at the moment, in the case of the Sahel, this dangerous cocktail that I described of climate change, of abject poverty and violent extremism, well, it so happens that those three topics are hot topics. We've just had the Sustainable Development Goals endorsed. We've just had COP21, the security agenda, or, you know, counter-terror agenda, if you want to call it that, is a very hot topic, as is migration. I think that anybody in Italy or Greece or Europe more generally has really been forced to consider this issue very carefully since last summer, when we started having more and more people arriving on European shores. Well, that will continue. It's not something that we can simply put a stop to. And I think that managing the inevitable makes much more sense than trying to stop it. So in the case of the Sahel, the fact that you've got a population growing so quickly and that some of these structural issues are so difficult to overcome in the next 5 to 10 years, there is every chance that we will be seeing more people from the region wanting to seek safety or indeed a better life elsewhere. So my word in donor capitals is we have to engage on all fronts across the Sahel, because it's the right thing to do for so many different reasons.
I think what we are trying also to achieve within FAO is convince the donors that we have also changed our mindset, that we can be innovative, we can propose new ways of doing things. Because indeed, the answer will be, well, why should we bother? We've been doing that for 20, 30, 40 years, and it's not changing. It's even deteriorating. And I think there was a turning point in maybe 2005, 2006, when it became unacceptable just to continue business as usual, not asking the right question, even to ourselves. Say, shall I just continue doing the same thing or shall I change? And I think there was a global recognition from partners, UN agencies, donors, countries, of course, that we need to propose a new package of interventions. So each time we can, we try to find solutions that could partly solve the problem. And I think that the heart of the resilience agenda, it's how do we do things differently? How do we mobilize differently the donor community? How do we make alliances with new partners? So that's really the message we want to convey with our donors, partners. And we are all in the same boat. I mean, it's not donors versus technical agencies. It's really all together. What kind of world do we want and what kind of answers we can propose? The second thing is that Sahel, I think, comes from the Arabic, and it means shoreline or border. It's a transition, an ecological zone between the Sahara and sub-Saharan Africa. And long time ago, the Sahara was almost impossible to cross. you would have difficulties to cross the Sahara and arrive in sub-Saharan Africa and vice versa. And you have this buffer zone, which is the Sahel. Today, this has changed completely, drastically, dramatically. There is no border anymore. And whatever happens in the Sahel, and we've seen there is a very dangerous cocktail, whatever happens there, the next day is in many other different countries and has immediate repercussions in the very long term, not just now with what we see with the migrants, but what will it be in 20 or 30 years if we are not able to respond to that, to respond to the needs of these migrants, but also to respond at the source where they come from. Viruses travel in no time all over the planet. Conflicts are exported and imported everywhere. So when we see such a situation evolving, it is our responsibility to ring the bell and say, well, we need to do something right now and certainly in a different way.